Good morning. I'm Jeremy Werner, and welcome to your morning conversation. Joining us this morning is Northwest Missouri State University Assistant Professor Alex Kurt. Alex, it's good to talk to you this morning.
Yeah, good to be here.
International Radio Day is coming up on February 13th, and at Wells Hall, where we are recording right now, there will be a celebration at 5 p.m. that evening with a program on the history of audio recording. So I guess I want to start off with something that's personal, but not like, you know, too personal. But I mean, from your own perspective, what was it that first got you into audio? What was the first thing, you know, whether it was a kid, teenager, college, or whatever, that, you know, you go, I love this, I want to learn more about audio? Was it like a band or a radio station?
Yeah, it was music. When I was, a really small child, I always liked to listen to music. And my parents had a record collection, and I used to spend a lot of time listening to records, and I always liked to sing and things like that when I was a little kid. And so when I was about 6 years old, my parents bought me a guitar and got me some lessons, and I didn't really take to it until I was maybe about 13, 14 years old. All that time, or a part of that time, I took guitar lessons, but I didn't really like the music that the teacher was teaching me, so I didn't spend much time practicing.
What music was that?
It was just stuff straight out of the Mel Bay book, you know.
Well, what did you want to play?
I wanted to play rock and roll and country and blues and all the stuff that I listened to in my parents' record collection.
Mm-hmm.
And my guitar teacher didn't teach me that, so I didn't really pay much attention to learning the guitar until I got to be a teenager. And then one of my friends at school had an older brother. It was in high school, and they had a band, and they all had electric guitars and stuff. And I used to bug my friend's older brother, and eventually he started to teach me some songs, taught me some power chords and things like that. And let me see, I think it was Black Sabbath, AC/DC, stuff like that. And then I got an electric guitar, and from there I started really learning as many songs as I could. And I would buy these tablature books that would tell how to play every riff in a Metallica album and learn them all, you know. And I started playing in bands when I first started high school, and I've actually played in bands ever since. Of course, being a lover of music, I listened to music a lot, and I was really captivated by the way that sound recordings sounded. Like, I paid a lot of attention to things like panning and weird effects that they would use on people's voices or guitars or drums or things like that, and I would always wonder, how did they do that? And so I would get these nerdy sound magazines and read those. We'd go to the bookstore, and I'd dig up all these sound magazines, Mix Magazine and all kinds of things like that, and Sound on Sound and all that kind of stuff, and Guitar Player Magazine, whatever I could find that would tell me more about that. And so we started making recordings with 4-track cassette recorders, and there was a recording studio in town, and my band and I wrote most of our own songs. So we went in and started recording albums, and, you know, we all had part-time after-school jobs that we would use to pay for the recording time. And I watched what the engineers were doing in the studio, and I remember thinking, number one, that it was really cool, and number two, that I could do it better than they were doing it. So I remember thinking, oh, what? Why did he do it that way? You know, you could just as easily have done it this other way, because all these things I'd read about in magazines and stuff, mm-hmm. you know. So as I got older and actually started playing shows that paid money and things like that, and getting in better and better bands, you know, naturally we wanted to make records to sell. And working in the studio, I always wanted to be one of the producers of the album, and then eventually I started learning the engineering side of things hands-on. And after we made a few albums, I started to think, that I could probably take the money that we were sinking into paying the engineer at the studio and just buy some equipment with it and do it myself. And ever since then, I've engineered pretty much every album that I've played on, except for a few here and there where I did guest musician spots for other people. But I've engineered all of my own band's albums since then. And that was probably 2004, maybe.
You see a lot of bands nowadays switching to making their own home studio as opposed to going to a studio and renting out time?
Yeah, most bands are doing that. You know, the problem is a lot of people don't really know what they're doing, because in spite of the fact that the equipment is accessible to everybody, not everybody knows how to use it, you know. But then you get people like Billie Eilish and her brother Phineas, and I mean, she just won 5 Grammys with an album that her and her brother recorded in her brother's bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be done.
It's crazy how it's evolved over the years, especially since audio recording began way back in the 19th century. What's one of the one things that just hasn't changed in your mind?
Sound. Mm-hmm. Sound waves haven't changed. Microphones have gotten much more sensitive, you know, much more accurate. But essentially, it's been the same ever since Emil Berliner's day, when he invented the first decent microphones, and Alexander Graham Bell's Volta Labs had quite a bit to do with that as well.
Now, when it comes to the medium in which it's being recorded on, you know, going back to, you know, when you were probably growing up and having vinyl records, why is it that you see vinyl records have made a comeback within the past decade?
Well, I think in a way it started out kind of as a fad. Maybe some hipsters thought it was cool to get vinyl records, get their albums or get their music recorded onto vinyl records. There's a collectability to a vinyl record, you know, a collectible aspect to it that you don't get with a digital file that you downloaded off the internet. Plus just the medium itself physically, if you look at, there's an album cover, there's plenty of room for lyrics, liner notes, thoughts, whatever, poetry, photographs, paintings, you know, all this artwork. People like that.
Yeah.
It's fun to put on a record and then sit there and look at the album cover in this big format, you know, as opposed to a CD. I mean, a CD's really small, you know, compared to a record. I think that has a lot to do with it. You know, there are a lot of people who say that vinyl sounds better than CDs. I think that's pretty much a matter of taste. 'Cause some record players sound really bad.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is a certain warmth to an analog recording, and there is a scientific aspect behind it, too, whereas a digital medium is going to cut off frequencies above and below the human range of hearing, 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz. But analog recordings capture even the sounds that your ears aren't supposed to be able to hear. But your body, as Rupert Neve said, your body is a giant ear. And I believe I read something where R. Murray Schafer talked about that as well, where there are millions of nerve endings in your entire body. And I don't know if you've ever listened to music loud or at a concert or something where you can feel those sound waves crashing into your body. A lot of those are sound waves you can't hear with your ears. And some scientific studies have been done where they say that mediums like MP3s, you know, there's an algorithm there that takes out a lot of information that supposedly we can't detect, at least with our ears. But supposedly your brain can detect the difference, but it's like almost a subconscious thing. And they say that in this experiment, they let people listen to an analog or completely uncompressed recording of their favorite song. and they had these brain scanners on their head, and they could see that all the pleasure centers of the brain were firing off, just like you'd expect. And then they let them listen to an MP3, like a compressed MP3 of not such great quality, and all the pleasure centers would be firing off, but then there would also be frustration centers firing off at the same time. So some scientists say that it lessens your enjoyment of music if you listen to music that way.
So what would be the most pure form of digital audio?
Digital audio would just be uncompressed.
Would that be like
wave?
Okay.
Wave files, AIFF files, FLAC files, just things that haven't been compressed and had little bits of information taken out of them to make them to where you can fit 5,000 songs onto a 32 gigabyte.
I assume that's why they're not popular with a lot of
audio files.
Yeah, or storage companies. You know, with streaming services like Spotify, and what do you see for the future of audio?
Well, Neil Young, the musician from the 60s, he sees the outlook as being fairly grim. He thinks we're headed down the wrong path because of MP3s and low-quality audio files and things like that. And I agree that that is not the ideal way to listen to any kind of recording. But, you know, if you're in a car going 70 miles an hour down the interstate, do you really hear that much of a difference between an MP3 and a WAV file? You know what I mean? Like, there's already a bunch of road noise and everything else. But in a perfect listening situation, you know, the ideal would be to listen to a WAV file or something that does sound really good. And I think the future of audio is probably headed in that direction where, as our storage mediums get smaller yet can hold larger and larger amounts of information, and as processors get faster and faster, you know, the world's getting ready to head to 5G now for wireless. I don't think it's going to be a problem to carry a full quality uncompressed FLAC file or a WAV file or something like that. I don't think it's going to slow things down just because things are going to get faster and faster. And I would expect that digital audio is going to get better and better. They're just going to add higher sample rates and bit depths, and I believe that it's just going to keep getting better and better, and we're going to be able to listen to those high-quality things much easier because of the improvements in our digital equipment.
Do you think it will be like video, where movie theaters were worried that Netflix and all these others were going to start taking away from their profit margin and their crowds, but all they really needed to do was keep doing what they're doing, but make it more of an experience, that it wasn't just seats. They had to add all these different things and other bells and whistles.
Right.
Do you see that where there's going to be some audiophiles out there who are like, yeah, I enjoy Spotify, but I want something more. I want something that sounds crisp. I want something that sounds rich. And do you see the industry going, oh, we're now going to offer this so that people can indulge on that as opposed to the average person?
I think it'll be mostly like what I was saying with the improvements of digital audio files, sample rates and bit depths, and speakers are always going to keep getting better and better. You know, some people have also added in things like surround mixes. Like, there's been surround mixes made of several Beatles recordings and Pink Floyd and these kinds of iconic rock and roll recordings, so that you can sit in a surround space and it sounds like you're right in the middle of the performers. And you get a lot of separation in the mix that way. So then you can start to hear, like, I heard, for example, the song Eleanor Rigby by the Beatles in a surround studio in Nashville. It was in Blackbird Studio. And it was a perfect room set up for surround, and they played the surround mix of this song. And for the first time, I could hear the hairs on the bows of the stringed instruments, you know, the cellos and the violins that were in that recording. I could hear the hairs dragging across the strings as if I was right there in the room with them. And that recording was made in the 60s, you know, which is proof that, you know, with a really nice microphone and a really nice recording system and some good engineers and producers, even in the 60s, their recording technology was very good. They may not have been able to mix 32 individual tracks all at the same time, like with Pro Tools, you know, they had to cut and splice tape and bounce down several tracks to one track and then put all those tracks together to be able to fit it onto a four-track recorder. But aside from that, their microphones and their tape recorders were top quality. I don't know that we've really surpassed that since then. It's such a wonderful sounding medium.
Well, we appreciate you coming in, talking about the history of audio, radio, and almost everything in between.
Yeah. So what we're going to do is I'm going to record a master disc recording, and then I'm going to be recording a couple of musicians from the Northwest Jazz Ensemble. And I'm hoping to make at least two recordings that night, possibly a third or a fourth. So what I'm hoping to do is put at least one or two of those recordings into the University Broadcasting Museum. And that, on that night as well, they're going to have tours of the Broadcasting Museum. Because of all the recent updates and improvements that they've made in there, they want to show it off. And then they also are going to be given tours of KXCV to show all the new renovations that have been done there as well.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yep.
Coming in.
Thanks a lot.
Once again, that was Northwest Missouri State University Assistant Professor Alex Kurt. And once again, International Radio Day, February 13th, 5 p.m. here at Wells Hall. I'm Jeremy Warner, and that was your morning conversation.